Welcome to the Mama Bear Dares podcast. I'm Leslie.
And I'm Tessie.
And we are sisters-in-law. We started this podcast because we knew there were so many women out there like us that were hungry for great conversation with our girlfriends. We love talking to our friends about, you know, the best deals on strollers and the best place to go for a family adventure. But we also love hearing what makes our girlfriends tick. We like to know the things that keep them up at night and the things that they're most passionate about. So we started this podcast to ask those questions and to provide a space for people who are like us and just dare to dig a little bit deeper into what this incredible life is all about. So on Mondays, we find women, their friends, their friends of friends, their people who have boldly suggested that either they or the people that they know and love come on this podcast. We invite them here and we interview them. On Wednesdays, we talk about other things that the Mama Bear community recommends or things that Tessie and I have on our minds. But today, like most Mondays, we will interview an incredible woman with a fierce Mama Bear inside her. Today we're welcoming actually a very special guest, one of our other sisters-in-law, Kate Klipsch. She is the only sister to our brother husbands, and even though she's the youngest of four, she has always inspired Tessie and I so much with her outlook on the world. We wanted to interview Kate and just introduce her to the Mama Bear community because she has a really interesting story that she has forged through her time spent in places like Mexico and Chile and Sri Lanka and Japan and Chicago and New York. And it's just given her this incredible perspective on the world and on our own country that a lot of people just don't get.
You're absolutely right. It's because of all of her experiences that we actually ended up talking with Kate for close to 2 hours. Our conversation with Kate just included such great information, especially for mama bears who, like us, are wanting to raise their children with social justice in mind. And we think you'll get a lot of the conversation with Kate. So today, we're actually just introducing part one of our Kate Clip series, our first series, that will prove what we've often said on this podcast. Travel has a way of changing your perspective and reminding you that your story isn't everyone's story. Hey, Mama Bears. We were going to post these in August, but this has been a hard week, hasn't it? We think our conversation with Kate is timely for the events that have taken place in Baton Rouge, Minnesota, and Dallas. We hope you'll listen to part one today and part two on Wednesday with open ears and with open hearts. We genuinely believe our Mama Bears need to be righteously angry for all of the lives murdered this week, and we believe the only way this can happen is by listening to voices of people of color who have been living different realities than those of us who are white, and to people like Kate, who, because of her experience as a social worker and world traveler, has come to realize the part her privilege has played and continues to play in America. Give us some grace on this one, Mama Bears. As white Americans, we are still learning too. So this is not meant to be comprehensive, but just a piece of the larger dialogue. Mostly, Mama Bears, we believe we are at a pivotal point in history, and we know that women have always and will always play a unique role in shaping it. We are capable of loving more than just our babies. We are capable of loving all people. Our Mama Bear is big enough to do it and should do it. Okay, on to the show.
Kate has always been very mature, but it's been a real pleasure in seeing how she has used this maturity to comfort people who have been through the worst as humans in her role as social worker and therapist and grief counselor. Kate really starts by saying that she was raised, like so many of us, in a comfortable upper middle class home, and that through the actions of her parents, she learned that it was really important to serve in some sort of capacity. As we've said before on this podcast, just with the introduction of our husbands, right? But she mentioned that her siblings have all gone to work in some sort of capacity or way that they're serving others. So, you know, their older brother works for the YMCA. My husband is a principal at an alternative high school. Zach also works at a Y camp. And Kate is currently a social worker in the New York City school system. So obviously there's lots of reasons why we love this collection of brothers and sister. But I think it really speaks to how coming from privilege does allow you the ability to, number one, make travel a priority. Mm-hmm. And number two, it allows you to engage with the world in a different way, knowing that even if you spend time in other countries or other places or other cities, you'll always have a place to land. You have this privilege of this family unit and, you know, a comfortable bed and a full belly. So, right. And lots of people just that love and support you.
Yeah, that's huge. And you and I got to see Kate kind of struggle through this juxtaposition of seeing people for the first time and hearing the stories of them growing up in a different way than she did. We got to see her go through that in real time when she was in college, right, mm-hmm. as a sister. And you especially, because you lived in Chicago the same time she did that she's talking about in the earlier part of the podcast. So you had a really close window seat to what she was going through. But I also think our listeners will hear her go through it in the interview as well. You can hear her process it, even though it's been, you know, a decade later almost. So I love when she talks about first realizing that everything she took for granted as a universal experience for people was actually not universal at all. Mm-hmm. This is kind of the risk, if you will, of growing up like many of us did. When everything's so safe, you come to believe that our experience, that experience, is the experience. And it blinds you to the reality that so many in the world, and even in our own country, face, right? Mm-hmm. It can be really jarring to witness that for the first time, because it really does shake the foundation you've built your life upon. And in so doing, you aren't able to just shrug off an entire group or population, because you know that they are clearly facing something in their life that you've never come close to experiencing. It really brings us closer to all of humanity when you first do that. But it's hard. It's really hard.
So hard. Yeah. And I mean, even, you know, as observers of Kate, like just to kind of be able to walk with her. And that's why I think people enjoy the conversation, because she can kind of educate us on some of these things that we come from a very similar background as Kate, but we certainly have not had the chance to experience. And I'm thinking in particular of one example that she gave about working on the south side of Chicago. She was driving. She had a car full of kids. She was speeding because they were late. And it didn't occur to her that she was able to speed and not get in trouble, whereas the kids that she was working with absolutely could not. So the tension that she talks about, where she kind of realizes she goes to these places, these areas to hang out with these young adults and work with these people, and just when she figures out, I guess, that they have such completely different realities than her own. And then the realization that she got to leave that at the end of the day and go home to her own safe, felt, you know, well-fed, well-loved reality. It's one that I think it's fascinating to kind of put yourself in that position or put yourself in the shoes of someone who has had that experience.
Absolutely. I vividly remember my first time really struggling with that exact tension when we went to Ethiopia to get Teriku. You know, I had to deal with this idea that, like, the son that I love was coming from this place where he was well loved, but faced hardships that he will never face here in America. And then wanting to help in a real, you know, I wanted to help in a real and honest way the people that we left behind in Ethiopia. So figuring out how to serve them and acknowledge their humanity, but then also we went back to the hotel that had plenty of food and clean water. So coming home from that trip, I just kept explaining it, and I'm sure you'll remember, it just was like, God, that was an amazing trip, but it wrecked me because that tension is hard. And we've talked about living in tension is just one of the hardest things we do as a human. We constantly want to escape it. But, you know, you have to come face to face with the privilege that's even in that tension, because not everybody then gets to leave and go get clean water and, exactly, you know, as much food as they could possibly. And I think that tension is why so many people don't do it. They don't face the privilege and they don't face that tension at all.
Yeah. And it's this really pretty unique population of people who have the opportunity, if you will, to live in that tension.
Yeah.
And many of our listeners are exactly in that position, that you know, the experience that Kate had growing up is probably very similar to the experience that you had growing up.
Yeah, and that we're raising our kids in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you brought up a good question in the interview. Kind of, you were talking about how we can teach our kids this lesson without them being kind of tortured by it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really valid one, because as mama bears, we want to protect our kids from the tension, and we don't want them to have to feel uncomfortable. But our interview with Kate is really about the risk of exposing our kids, and of course ourselves also, to their own privilege versus the reward of being able to relate to all of humanity because you've exposed yourself.
Oh, exactly. I mean, I think it's pretty clear for anyone who has listened to this podcast for any amount of time how you and I feel about it, but about that, about exposing our kids to their own privilege and to the experiences of other people. But our conversation with Kate just reminded me that we can't walk through that for our kids. As much as we want to try to do this for them, this has to be something that they do themselves. And we just have to be there to support them and encourage them while they walk through it, right? Mm-hmm. And I love, you called it kind of planting a nugget of curiosity, which when you say nugget, there's something so adorable about it. But just this
nugget,
just this nugget of curiosity, how maybe it's just our jobs as their parents to plant that little seed of curiosity and then allow our kids to explore it in their own unique ways.
Yes. And in the first part of our interview, we also talk on immigration and how the narrative in America is that people are so desperate to get to America because it's the best. But what Kate learned, and actually, if you go back a few episodes, what we learned from Cynthia Vanderpool Garcia, we can link that in the show notes, it's actually that these people are wanting to stay where they are. They want to stay with their family and friends in their own home countries and communities. And the only reason that they're immigrating is because they're so desperate. Ugh, if they would just have access to jobs in their community, you know, think of how different their experience would be. And I thought it was a really great moment and an important distinction for anyone talking about immigration.
Oh, to be sure, that's a really important distinction. Kate talks about NAFTA, and if you were like me, Mama Bears, when you get to that point, you'll remember NAFTA. This was signed into law in 1993, so, you know, I was not old enough to really know kind of what it means, so I just wanted to talk for a second about that. It stands for the North American Free Trade Agreement. And its goal really was to eliminate the barriers to trade and investment between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. It kind of set in motion the elimination of tariffs on Mexican and U.S. exports. It didn't have full elimination of tariffs at that time, but kind of in the most recent decade and all of that, most of the tariffs have now been lifted. So I just wanted that little piece of information to give it some context when Kate's talking about that. But she really speaks on how NAFTA affected the community she was working in, Mexico, and how she realized at that time that being an American, even though you think, like, how could me as an American really affect change in this small community in Mexico? It does, because she gets to vote. And like she said, obviously at the time of NAFTA, she wasn't able to, but her vote now as an almost 30-year-old woman directly affects these international communities and organizations. So Kate was talking about a time years ago, but it definitely rang true for our current political climate as well. For me, just how important our vote in the U.S. can affect communities around the world. And I think that's obviously really important this year in an election cycle. I have my degree in communication, as you know. And my parents are so pleased that I'm finally using it on this podcast, I'm sure. But I really loved the part that Kate was talking about her time in Sri Lanka. She only ended up learning kind of rudimentary bits of the languages while she lived there. But so much of her conversations she talks about with the people were nonverbal. You know, she speaks on how she had these deep connections because she had to be totally present in how she was feeling at the moment and how the other person was feeling at the moment. And she had to be able to interpret the needs and expressions of the Sri Lankan people. And she says it so beautifully. She said, the rupturing of that connection was incredibly, incredibly painful. And this idea, this, you can kind of get that mental image, right, of a rupture of a connection. And immediately when she said that, both in real time in our interview, and then also when I was listening back to it, I thought immediately of Ethiopia and how whenever we go back there and get to spend time with our important people there, it feels like that. It feels like we have this deep connection, even though we don't share a language, but we share a common love, you know, in our sons. And then we leave and there is a depression and an anxiety and all of that, even though it doesn't make sense on the surface because we're not speaking the same language. We're not actually talking to each other, but that doesn't make the connection any less deep.
Yeah, I love that connection that she just brings to life when she talks about her travels of just, you know, we go across cultures. Like a mama bear is so big.
Yes.
One more thing that I think we should point out is just how Kate talks about how she really got to shape her identity during the time that she spent in other countries. So in America, we're often so categorized. I mean, even our littlest children kind of do it. They want to know, you know, is this a boy? Is this a girl? Is this, you know,
yeah,
which is this a grandpa? Is this, they like to know what category people are a part of. And so this transcends, you know, it's who our family is, it's how much money we have, what our sexual orientation is, what our occupation is, our political party. There's so many different categories and ways that we are defined. Mm-hmm. This obviously happens in other countries too, but Kate spoke about the ways in which travel allows a person to kind of ditch all of those identities and just be whoever you are in that moment. And I love that idea.
Yes.
Sri Lankan people, they didn't love her because of who she was back in America, but just the person that she was standing right there before them. That's just, it's such a beautiful sentiment.
I know. I love the idea that my kids would be able to choose their own identity that's not wrapped up in mine, right? One that clearly has roots, because again, Kate points back to her privilege of having this loving home to return to. So, you know, giving my kids a foundation, but also allow them to explore who they are in the inside and then give them room to kind of change lanes as needed as they grow, because we all grow and change, right? Mm-hmm. So this part one is full of really great stuff. I think it's time that we drop into our conversation with our sister, Kate.
All right, let's do it.
Hey, Mama Bears. Today, we have a very special guest. Leslie and I are talking to one of our other sisters-in-law, Caitlin Klipsch. We're so excited to talk to her. We have loved Kate, obviously, for the many decades since becoming her sister, but we've watched as she went from being a really incredible teenager who felt and responded to the world more like a 30-year-old even at 14 and 15.
She's always been much more mature than either of us.
And much more mature than I've been. But we've watched as she evolved from this teenager to now she's about to turn 30, and she's always greeted the world in a totally unique perspective. Leslie and I have been inspired by her since she was 14, 15.
Before she could drive.
Exactly.
She's been teaching us all kinds of things.
So we knew when we started this podcast that we'd want you all to hear from Kate and just get a glimpse into why she's been a beloved sister of ours and just an incredible woman moving throughout the world. So, Kate, let's just officially welcome you to the Mama Bear Dares podcast.
Thanks, sisters.
Yay! It's so fun to have you here. So, Kate, let's jump right in. Let's talk about just what was it about your upbringing or the places that you found yourself that have really shaped the woman that you are today?
Well, you know, I grew up like similar to how you guys did and probably a lot of your listeners and your husbands, obviously. but in, you know, a middle to upper class white family in the Midwest. But I think in a family that, you know, similar to most, was always really busy and active and doing a lot of things, but also kind of had this narrative, I would say, of like quote unquote giving back, mm-hmm. And whatever that means, but like working within nonprofits and kind of this idea that, you know, whatever you were going to do with your life, should be something that, helps others, or, I mean, and now we're all in helping professions in some sort, working for either nonprofits or schools, basically. Mm-hmm. So I think there was that, and then that was left open to interpretation of what that means. But at the same time, it was really a very comfortable, privileged, and loving environment to grow up in. So gave a lot of like stability to be able to explore what that means for each of us, which I think is why we're all doing, you know, similar type of work, but in very different ways and in different locations and things like that. But there was always something in me that wanted to like try some new things and go places. And so I went to Chicago for college and was really like blown away at just the city. I loved it. But just the kind of different worlds that were inhabited within Chicago. And so realizing that there was kind of just like people living in completely different realities within the same city. And I just kind of, as I started to study social work, not sure if that's what I wanted to do, I started to like kind of notice that and think about that. And then really wanted to travel. So I started traveling and going abroad and studied abroad in South America. And then as I continued studying social work, traveled more and just fell in love with it and realized I could learn so much about myself by being around people that were absolutely nothing like me. And I could learn so much about what it means to be a human and just loved it so much. And I think it's, it really shaped, who I am. And now that I've been living in the U.S. for a few years, which is the longest since I was growing up in Iowa, realizing, what that means for me and like being able to kind of learn from the people around me now within the country that I was raised in.
I think we can, Leslie, you'd probably agree here too, but Zach and I often talk about you moving to Chicago to go to Loyola was really where we saw you grow the most. And I think college kind of has that effect on a lot of people. But this is where your eyes were opened and you continued to let the world break you just a little bit at a time. So what do you think it was about Chicago or about some of the classes you took or you had and continue to have amazing, incredible friends from there who were also very socially active and socially aware? So what do you think it was about that community or that city that did that for you?
Yeah, I think it was a little bit of all the things you mentioned. I think it was the friends that I had. It was Loyola is a Jesuit school, and even though I was not Catholic, did not consider myself Catholic, the Jesuits typically have a pretty, like, social justice ideology and, like, mission, so that was definitely a big part of it, and there was always opportunities to serve, to, like, learn more about social justice and progressive issues, and a lot of the friends that I had were really doing, like, incredible things. Loyola is one of the schools, one of the many schools that sends support students to go down to the School of Americas to protest all the military training that happens there, and just a lot of other things. And so a lot of the professors also are pretty progressive, and was able to just learn about a lot of things that growing up I did not mm-hmm. learn about. And I think then traveling and my junior year going studying abroad in Chile, it was incredible. But I think the biggest thing about it was just seeing how, you know, I found a community in Chicago when I first went there that pushed me and taught me a lot, but was also pretty similar to how I grew up. And we were kind of learning together. And then went to Chile, and it was all of a sudden I was like, for the first time in my life, really exposed to people that grew up nothing like me, completely nothing like me. And that's who I was living with, and that's who I was going to school with, and that's who I was, you know, getting to know. And just kind of, I think it scared me a little bit, but mostly just kind of put things in perspective and made me realize that everything I took for granted as like a universal thing about people was not at all. And it was the first time that I was like, oh, wow, all the things I thought it meant to be a human is not actually necessarily what it means to be a human, and started to really think, like, what, so then what does it mean to be a human? What are the things that I have in common with, you know, whether it's the people in, like, Santiago, where I was living, who arguably I had a lot more in common with because they just lived in a city, and that city is very kind of a lot modeled after the U.S., or when I traveled to the south and was in the mountains and was going through some more, like, indigenous communities and things like that, or in the north where it's like farmers and it's like a desert and it's people living in really small communities up there, and just kind of starting to learn that. And then coming back to Chicago, and at this point I'm much further along in my social work education and starting to do work like on the south and southwest sides. And then all of a sudden, that was, I think, probably the hardest semester for me, was my fall semester senior year, where I realized, like, I didn't need to go to another country or another continent to do that. It was a couple miles away from where I was living in Chicago. And at that point, I was living on, like, the near south side, but working on the far south side and the southwest sides, and just seeing that, like, even there, what it means to grow up is 100% different from what it meant for me to grow up, and really being shook really deeply in that, and just feeling like I would never be able to do enough, and kind of just having this, like, this crisis of, you know, what it means, and starting to take stock of all my privilege, which I hadn't really before then, and realizing that, trying to figure out what this meant for me and for my future as I'm finishing school and planning to go to grad school, and figuring out what kind of work I want to do, and probably setting my sights a little too high at that point of wanting to, like, make large policy changes and doing all these things because I'm just starting to learn about this stuff at 22 or whatever.
That's what
it was.
22-year-olds are supposed to do.
Thank God for the 22-year-olds. So that's interesting, and you talked before about part of what was great about growing up for you was that stability that your parents really provided, and so with that stability, you were able to become who you were meant to be because the basics were covered. You didn't have to think about that.
Absolutely.
So talk about maybe just your work on the South Side as you were considering your privilege, which the stability is part of that privilege, and just sort of at a really basic level, what did that all mean to you? When you talk about privilege, what does that mean? When you talk about the work that you were doing, what did you see about your experience that you hadn't really even understood before?
Yeah, I think it was, it's interesting now to, like, look back from my perspective right now, which is, like, having worked again in the country for a while. I feel like I haven't had conversations about my work as much in the last few years. When I was traveling and living abroad, people were always asking me about why I was doing that and how I got into that, and I think now that I've been working in the U.S. for a few years, it's kind of interesting to, like, come back to then thinking about my work in the U.S. again.
Mm-hmm. Right, because you've had stops in Japan where you were doing education work, and then in Sri Lanka where you were counseling child soldiers, right? Former child soldiers.
Yeah, so I think at that time, though, it was starting to realize exactly that, just the privilege of that stability, of at the most basic level of never having to worry about if there was food to eat, if I had a place to live, and then if I could get to a good school, which I could, and if I could get there safely and not have to worry about violence. And I think a lot of it was that. It was just those, like, incredibly basic elements, never having to think about police, only thinking positively about police and that they wanted to protect me. And I think just, like, it was little things. I mean, I would, on principle, on, like, I'm going to do this because of my privilege type principle, I would take a long train ride down the Red Line in Chicago, get off at 63rd and the South Side, and take a bus through Inglewood, which is, like, arguably the worst, the most dangerous neighborhood in Chicago. And I would, or at least it was at that time, this was, I guess, a while ago. And I would take a bus through Inglewood to get to the neighborhood where I was working. And even just that, like that process of you getting to a certain point and there's no longer any white people on the train after a certain point on the South Side, and then never on the bus. And understand, like, thinking about that and seeing, just trying to just start taking things in and seeing how people were relating to each other, how people were relating to police often, and then working with young people and that same experience. So talking to them, and I remember talking to, like, a coworker actually who was, he was technically one of the youth, but he was, like, older than me, but he was a youth organizer, but he was, like, I think 23 or 24, and I was only, like, 21, 22. And talking to him, like, over a break because we became friends, and him talking about, like, being involved in a shooting right around Christmas, and just, it was so normal for him, and just being blown away. Because, not that I didn't think it happened, but I didn't know anyone it had happened to, so there was no way for me to, like, relate it, and I remember just being terrified for him, and him being like, no, like, this is just normal, like, this is what life is like. And so I think that, like, knowing things are happening, but the, like, normalization of it, or driving with a few of the young men to an event and speeding through the South Side of Chicago because we were late to this event, and having police, like, zoom up next to us on the passenger side because there was kids in the, like, all around, teenagers zooming up, and then they saw me and backing away and letting it go, and all the kids laughing and being like, oh, that's hilarious, like, it's so glad it was you, because that's the only reason they didn't stop us. And just, and, like, that's such a simple thing, and for, like, people of color, that's such a normal experience all the time. But for me, I was 22 and experiencing that for the first time and being like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? And just having no idea.
Right.
So I think kind of all of those things, and really struggling with for the first time, the idea that, like, I got to go home at night. So I still got to, like, what did it mean that I would go and, like, be and, like, observe and kind of experience in my own way during the day a few days a week, but then be able to be like, but I'm going to drive back up or take the train back up to my, like, safe apartment with my, like, supportive friends, with, you know, my, like, supportive family, financially supportive family, knowing that, like, I'll have everything I need when I get there. And, like, the starting to feel a tension in that too. Like, what does that mean to, like, pop in and pop out of that community, and, like, the privilege of that, and knowing that it was a privilege to get to observe and be part of that, and that I could leave at any time I wanted, you know, and that trying to understand and, like, start to, like, reckon with what that meant.
I remember as your sister watching you process that, because as a 21 and 22 year, right now you're speaking as a 30-year-old and
29.
Okay.
29 listeners.
As a 29-year-old. And when we watched you as a 21, 22-year-old when you were doing that, there was a lot of anger on your part. Mm-hmm. You were almost angry that you had that privilege. You almost felt like, why can't I give some of my privilege to the people that I'm seeing walk through this every day? And we could feel your tension at wanting to, again, undo some of that privilege, but also being reliant on it. And it was hard to watch you go through that, because that's a young person. 21 and 22 is a very young person. And they don't often have the perspective that even a 29-year-old has, you know? So how do you, when you were talking about that, I was thinking as a mom, like, oh, I want my kids to have that perspective. I want my kids at a younger age than I was when I learned that. I want them to learn that as quickly as possible. But I also saw you go through it. And so as a mom, I want to protect them from that.
Right.
So is there a way that you can walk through that and not be tortured a little bit?
No, I don't necessarily think there's a way you can do it without hurting a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I think, part of it, part of the anger came from feeling like I could have been aware of some of these things earlier and been a little more eased into it. Than having to like learn it myself at such an older age in my mind. Like, and it is, I do think that. And I think feeling like there was a lot of opportunities that I could have been more aware of things than I was. And so I think that's where a lot of the anger came. And I think it was this complex thing that I'm always feeling, especially as a social worker working in, I mean, anywhere, I was going to say an urban area, but anywhere really, like feeling like this mixture of the privilege and then some guilt related to it. And then the guilt of of feeling privileged and being able to like, knowing that feeling of feeling bad about your privilege is in itself a privilege because, you know, like
right.
that this like maze complex of not super helpful feelings in any way,
right.
like not really helpful. And I think that was it, is at that time, especially, it was so paralyzing. And I'm so thankful that I just did it, that I just got through it. And I think I'm sure I had like you guys and my parents and family members just being like, just do it, like just get through it. And I was able to trust that. But I think, yeah, that it was like a really hard thing at that time. And we talk about this all the time about like how, because I don't have kids, so I don't, you know, I don't know that, but of how to like introduce some of these ideas to your guys' kids. We talk about this a lot. And I think, I mean, I defer to you guys because you have kids, but I do think that idea, I mean, your kids are already more aware because of the work that you guys do and the conversations that you have with them. And I think just generationally too, like there's a part of me that feels like I was protected from a lot of stuff. And there are times where I get overwhelmed with how terrible things in the world are. And I think like, I'm so glad I didn't know that for a while, you know, like that when I was 12 and 13, there was not a whole lot I could have done at that point. So I'm okay with not necessarily knowing that. But then when I look at the longer term and think like, but I didn't necessarily need to wait until that point to learn it. I think it's a mix, but it all depends on like how you see the world and how, and like what you do with it once you start to figure it out and start to like realize your place in it and your role and what, like whatever responsibility you feel based on the privilege that you've had. I think that's what matters, whatever time you figure it out or start to learn about it or start to tap into it.
Mm-hmm. When you were talking, I was thinking as a mom about how our first inclination, again, is to protect them. All the moms around are like, oh, yeah, I want my kids to feel safe and protected and loved while they're with me. And so there is that balance, because Leslie and I constantly talk about, even on this podcast, like, but how do we let our kids know that their experience is not the experience of the world, of their community, of this country? There's that tension as a mom. How much do I inform them and how much do I just protect them until they have to learn? Because at some point, some of my kids will have to learn these truths, you know?
Right.
And so is it our responsibility or is it the world? It's really hard. Do you feel that tension, Leslie?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, raising kids now was different than when, like, your mom was raising you, just because we have so much more access
Absolutely.
To information.
Yeah.
And so it's a totally different ballgame, I think, these days. And, you know, who knows what that would have been like for you as a kid growing mm-hmm. up with something like Facebook and, you know,
Absolutely.
That sort of thing. And so it does, in some ways it's great because it does force these conversations with kids. I think it's great because
right.
I do want my kids to know these things. You know, I, as you were saying, like, what's the appropriate dose of reality to
right.
feed to a 6-year-old or a 9-year-old or a 12-year-old? But in a lot of ways, we are becoming more connected as the human family. And so then you're, of course, talking more about these things. And we can learn from our experiences and the experiences then that you've had and just being a bit younger and just continue, I guess, to do the best we can.
Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely.
What that is.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's totally true. I think the technology piece is incredibly important of how you can't stop it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, both of your eldest kids now have phones and
mm-hmm.
access to at least some social media. And obviously, like, I mean, unless he's unfollowed me, which maybe he has, Tristan is going to see every article I post about everything and whatever I'm feeling about, you know, these issues and things like that. And just like anything else on Facebook or whatever else he's on, that I think that's definitely true. So it's a totally different conversation, I feel like, for you guys, and thinking about our parents, who not only, like, the way for them to educate themselves was, newspapers and, like, nightly news, which is completely different. Completely different to hear those, like, outside narratives is totally different. And also, I think, in thinking about, like, our parents that went through a lot of, like, really scary times, like, going through the Cold War and, like, Vietnam War and things like that. And so, when I think of that, like, I'm sure if I went through that, I would just want to, like, protect my kids and not let them, and, like, let them feel as little, like, fear and pain as possible. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, totally makes... And I think that's a thing that is a difference between my 22-year-old self and my 29-year-old self, even not having kids. Whereas, like, at 22, I was much more, like, self-righteous and, like, angry that I didn't know these things and probably took it out on everyone and my education and my parents and all these things. And I think as a 29-year-old, I have that, like, broader perspective where I can be like, oh no, like, I get it, and, like, way less angry about the privilege I had growing up. And I think much more able to see, like, the bigger context, like I can about other issues and my own privilege, understanding, like, that's okay, maybe, that I didn't, like, have to feel that growing up. And meeting people who did feel, like, were much more aware of things, who in a lot of ways I idolize and look up to because they've been doing really incredible, like, work, social justice work since they were in high school and thinking about that. But understanding that with that, a lot of times has come a lot of anxiety and a lot of, like, other issues that are really difficult too, that there's a part of me that's like, I'm okay with the fact that I didn't experience that until my 20s.
Right.
That's okay.
Yeah. And if nothing else, I mean, depending on where your family is kind of on that spectrum of, like, where, what do you want your kids to know? What don't you want your kids to know? What are you comfortable with examining about your own life? Just, it's, I think, kind of, it can come down to sort of this nugget of curiosity. And if you can plant a nugget of curiosity in your kids, then I think then they can take their own journeys, but hopefully have that basic sort of, you know, that critical thinking, curious component.
That's good. Yeah. After your time in Chicago, you went to Mexico and lived there for a time. What was your biggest takeaway from your time in Mexico?
Mexico is really interesting because I had only previously been to Chile, where I was studying abroad, and even though there was, like, a social justice component, it was still study abroad. Mm-hmm. It was still a lot of, like, just traveling and drinking and, like, just meeting people and having fun. And then Mexico was, I was there as an internship for my master's in social work for a summer, so for a few months. So I was really there to, like, work for the first time. I went there alone, so that was different than Chile. Also, it was no one had done this internship before. I had worked with a professor to set it up who had connections there. And so I just went, and not knowing anyone or what I was really going to be doing, and just worked for this really incredible community foundation, this organization that did, like, economic development and educational development in really small towns in central Mexico. So I also wasn't around a big city. The city I lived in was called Irapuato, and it was, like, a very industrial city in the middle of central Mexico, in the state of Guanajuato. And I was trying to help with fundraising. I didn't really know what I was doing, but it looked good for them to say that they had an American student there, helping with fundraising. I just kind of supported the director, who, it was just a complete, like, it was her entire life. She was so passionate about it. She usually didn't take a salary because she just, all the money, she didn't have a lot of money, and it all went to the work. And the basic ethos of the organization was that this was a center that, especially after NAFTA, had the highest level of emigration. So almost everyone, and at the point I was going, which was in 2009, that included women and men around 13, 14, 15 would all immigrate because there was just nothing there. There was no schools. There was no way to make money. So if you wanted, you had to go to the U.S. And so her idea was trying to develop educational opportunities and economic opportunities so that they didn't have to. So she would go into these small communities, work with the people there to figure out businesses that they could set up, get teachers to come in, and try to figure things out so that they didn't have to immigrate. So I think in that process, I mean, one big takeaway for me was like that I loved it. And I found that I loved going to a place, not knowing what was going to happen when I got there, being the like weird tall white lady in this community, where people were going to stare at me and ask me questions, and I felt fine with it. And I liked it. And, I loved not knowing. I had this weird thing where I remember telling our other sister-in-law, Emily, actually about it, that I was like, I love like going somewhere and being like, I don't know where I'm going to shower next, which is weird. But like, there's something about that of just being like, I don't know what's ahead. And there's nothing I can do about it. And it was so freeing to feel like it's out of my hands. Like, I have no control over a lot of this stuff. And, like, once I get there, I'll figure it out and I'll make it happen. Obviously, that comes with a lot of privilege to be able to say that. But I think I just realized how much I loved that. And so getting to, like, know incredible people. And I ended up working with a lot of Mexican college students who were also doing, they have to do, every college student in Mexico has to do at least one semester or a summer of a social service internship. Mm-hmm. So I was working with a lot of students from Mexico City who I'm still in touch with. Like, we had a great experience. So I think it was that made me realize, like, I love this and I love doing this kind of international work and just being able to go and not really know what was happening, and learned a lot about the organization and what was working and what wasn't working, and got to work under this like incredibly intelligent, passionate woman who I've somehow like almost always worked for organizations where women were in leadership, and have seen that be seen like great leaders and not great leaders, and I got to see just kind of like the side where she was incredibly passionate. But that was what was carrying her through and didn't have a lot of, like, stability in the organization. Mm-hmm. But I think that was my biggest takeaway from Mexico, was, like, realizing that that's what I wanted to do, was to keep just getting on planes and going places.
Well, and you learned a lot about immigration, you know, just, like, that huge, big subject that's always on our news feed, but you got to see really personally what that is like for people. Immigration can sort of, you can forget that there are real people that are, you know, not necessarily like running to the U.S. because, ooh, I'm going to get rich in the U.S. It's because there are no options where Absolutely. They currently
and how running. Little they wanted to immigrate.
Right.
Anybody I talked to that had been, there was some people who had been there and either, most of them just came back. Some had like been deported, had been caught and deported. But that they all said, when I would say, like, where would you like to live? They all said, here. Like, they were like, look at it. It's, mm-hmm. we're all just hanging, like, we're our families, we're together. Yeah. I'm with my kids. This is where I want to be. But there's no work here. There's no work, so I can't be here. And it's been interesting at times working in the U.S. and working with migrants who had come for that reason that were just desperate to go back to their families but couldn't and said there's zero way to make money there, so I can't, I have to be here, and were experiencing terrible things and had gone through terrible things to get there, and that was exactly it in that community was, and I think getting to see that over a few months, my dad came to visit and I remember him saying the same thing and just being like blown away and saying like, this is just crazy, like these people don't want to go and they have to go, and it's a totally different thing, and how unhappy they all so much would talk about how unhappy they were in the U.S. And of course how much they missed their families and wanted to be back but just couldn't. And this community specifically was so incredibly affected by NAFTA because they were all farmers. Mm-hmm. And then once NAFTA happened, they lost their market for the corn especially that they were making, and so they all their farms went under and they were no longer able to do that. And so that too, like understanding like that the policy aspect of, as a social worker, learning about a lot of policies like that, and all of a sudden seeing like, oh wait, like, but I vote for the politicians who make those policies. Mm-hmm, right. So then like coming full circle of realizing that I am much more connected to that farmer that's no longer able to work in central Mexico. Like, I couldn't have voted at that time in 94, 96, whenever it was, but realizing that, like, that mm-hmm. I'm connected with that. And I think that was another takeaway for me going forward, even as I'm traveling abroad and doing work internationally, realizing, like, the things I'm seeing not only in my own country, which I hadn't worked as much as I have now, but in these other countries, being like, I still, because I'm an American and can vote and was born there, I have power over these situations too. Like, I am implicit and connected to these situations in all these various countries that I've been in, which is huge as well.
Yeah.
I remember you being there and talking to you about that experience, because at that time in my life, I had different outlook on the world as well. And the narrative that I heard constantly about immigration was that they were desperate to come to the United States. Because America's America. America's this amazing country that everyone would, of course, want to live in, given the opportunity. And so that was my first real reckoning with the idea and the knowledge that, of course, they don't want to leave their family and friends and their community and a country where everyone looks like them and speaks their language and all of that. That was the first time that I actually considered that, which is terrifying to understand and to remember so viscerally. But listeners, if you're just hearing this and like, oh my gosh, I never considered that, you're not alone. This is something we don't have to, as Americans, necessarily relate with. You know, we don't have to think about that. And so I remember that and being a little jealous that you were learning that at such a young age, to be quite honest with you. But you had said one of your biggest takeaways was just learning that this is what you wanted to do. And Mexico was really when we said goodbye to Kate, because you continued to travel for many years after that. After Mexico, you went to Sri Lanka. So can you tell us a little bit about that and your work there?
Yeah, so I came back first, actually, and finished grad school in Chicago, finished my master's in social work, and then that was it. Then I was done and had to figure out what I was going to do. So a couple weeks before graduation, a friend who was working at this really incredible organization called National Immigrant Justice Center, NIJC, in Chicago, which does really great work, is part of a large organization called Heartland Alliance. And they were looking for someone to go to Sri Lanka and do kind of like program management, program evaluation. So basically they give money to this counseling center in Sri Lanka, and they needed someone to just go and observe how the money was being spent and how the program was going, and for a couple months, and write a couple reports about it, so that reports for them and the larger funder, which was the State Department, actually. That was it. I knew nothing about Sri Lanka. All my work and focus had been about Latin America because I spoke Spanish. I had done work on immigration. So everything had been focused on that. But I knew I wanted to travel. My life motto at that point was like, don't ever say no. If they're going to pay me to at least live, then I'm not going to say no to it, which I'm so grateful that I did that. I interviewed, I got it, and like, 4 weeks later, 3 or 4 weeks later, I went to Sri Lanka, did kind of a crash course in everything about them and their history. And they had only, this was in summer of about May of 2010. And their 26-year civil war had only ended 1 year before. So it was a very new post-war situation. And that was all new to me. I mean, I lived in Chile and Mexico, like completely different situations. And so it was all new, not just the culture, not just the language. I didn't know the language, either of the languages that they spoke there. So it was really new, and it was pretty shocking when I first landed in Colombo. I had been pretty naive and just thought, like, it'll be fine, and it was okay. But there was almost no tourism at that point. It was 1 year after a very, very bloody civil war. So there was no tourism. And I remember just walking around, and I kind of got, like, swindled by a taxi driver, and just, I remember just crying and, like, feeling so upset and trying to go, and I was clearly jet-lagged as well, but trying to go eat lunch, and there was no silverware, and I just started crying at the table at, like, it was, like, 3:30 in the afternoon because of the jet lag, so I was the only person in there, and I just started crying because I didn't know how to eat the food in front of me, and I didn't know what everything was. And I was trying to be a vegetarian, but I had no idea what I'd ordered. And finally, like, the nice man came over and, like, gave me a spoon. So I still, and it, like, showed me what I was supposed to pour on what things to, like, eat. It was all, like, rice and curry, but I just didn't know what to do. And just feeling like I was in over my head. And then, and this was in Colombo, which is, like, this giant, bustling, like, crowded city. And then I was picked up by the organization I was going to work with and driven to the other side of Sri Lanka, to a town called Batticolo, which, on the eastern side, which was more, like, war-torn, where I would be living and working, and it was immediately, like, I could breathe again. As soon as I went there, it was so much calmer. It's a small town. I was obviously with the organization, who all the, like, leadership and staff pretty much spoke English. And it was, I mean, Sri Lanka was easily the most formative experience of my whole life, probably, definitely at that point. So my job was this, they had a rehabilitation center for children and teenagers who had been combatants, who had been soldiers in the war on either side. But typically in that country, it's the rebel side, which was the Tamils. I wasn't really doing any direct service work. My work was just to, like, oversee how things were going. But they would get, it was like a safe center, basically, where they lived there. They got very, very basic education because most of them had stopped school once they entered the war. Some planning to be relocated back in their communities, if possible. Some of them were never going to be able to go back to their communities. Some of their communities no longer existed. It was completely off the map from anything I'd ever experienced. It was like every time I went, it was this whole new thing. And so Sri Lanka was even more beyond anything I'd ever been. And it was still very tense. It was a really, like, everyone was still really worried that the war might start again, that fighting might start again. A lot of people in that area believed that was a possibility. I mean, I was technically there on a tourist visa because they didn't give out work visas because they didn't want international workers coming in and seeing the refugee camps that were still there that were terrible. Disappearances were still happening. A lot of sexual assault, like a lot of terrible things were happening. So they didn't give those out. So I was on a tourist visa. If they found out I was working, I could have been deported. I was riding the wave of, like, my enthusiasm and my privilege of being able to, you know, just jump in with, you know, without looking. That, I mean, I'm really, really appreciative for. As I look back, I think about, like, all the privilege that allowed me to do that, that I was harnessing, but that allowed me to have this incredible experience that I'm so, so grateful that I was able to have. And so, honestly, all day I would pretty much hang out with the kids. And, you know, these were young people who really hadn't gone to school, had only known war their entire lives, had been surrounded by war, had seen the most incredibly terrible things, had done incredibly terrible things, had had them done to them, just all, like, the worst things you could imagine. And it was the most, like, joyful experience I've ever had. Like, the way that they were able to exist and live in life. And obviously I worked really hard to learn the language while I was there, so I could communicate very basically by the end, but...
Well, tell us the languages. Is it Tamil and...
Tamil is the language is there. Sinhalese is the language of kind of the government, and in Colombo is the main language. Okay. The war was about, you know, obviously it's a long history, but it was like an ethnic tension. It was a post-colonial... The British had favored the Tamils, so it very similar to Rwanda, actually. So when the British left, the Sinhalese, which were the majority, there was more of them, then kind of started some pogroms and things in Tamil communities, and then the Tamils, like, rebuilt and had their own government, basically, and system, and then that was where the conflict came from. So where I was living, everybody spoke Tamil, and some people spoke English. And so I couldn't obviously talk about their, like, the deeper things that were undoubtedly happening for them and the PTSD and things like that. But I could sit around with them, and they were like fascinated by me. A lot of them had never even seen a white person on TV. I mean, their media was India. So a lot of them, I mean, children were terrified of me. like, little kids would literally look at me and cry because they had no frame of reference for, like, why I looked so ghost-like.
Well, and you're 6'1", and you have red hair and white skin. I mean,
even here, I look terrified.
You're terrified. Beautifully terrified.
So So, yeah, definitely. So a lot of times they just would touch my skin and they just wanted to, like, dress me up. And like, I just, and it was great because I just let them do whatever I want. They wanted to brush my hair out. And even that, like, it was so fascinating and important for me that I would sit and be like, you know, like, they could do whatever they wanted. And I often wouldn't, you know, like, in my own, like, they love to take my hair, which is, like, pretty curly, and brush it out and just, like, make this big frizz ball, which is, like, the opposite of what I'd ever want to do with my hair. But for whatever, for them, that was, like, beautiful, and they just loved it. Oh, and they just loved it. And I would just, of course, like, why would I care what they do with my hair? And so I would just let them do whatever they wanted. And, you know, as I would go over, a lot of times I would go, and the girls would immediately put, like, a bindi, is what they say in India. I don't actually remember the word, but in between my eyes. And so eventually they would do it every time I saw them. The first thing they would do is that. So eventually I just started wearing them every day because it was just easier. So, I mean, by the end, I tried to dress like them. They would buy, like, the kids wouldn't buy me clothes. The staff, who I became really, really, like, really good friends with, one of the staff members, he would take me and, like, buy me, which he had no money, but he would go and take me to buy stuff, and I would usually try to buy it, but saris and things, like, the girls would make me saris, like, incredibly beautiful saris that I still have. And I think just that of, like, that, what I often try to say when I try to explain why Sri Lanka was so important to me was that because, especially with the kids who didn't speak any English, because I couldn't communicate with them using words, which is the go-to for humans, I would say, we had to, like, communicate and commune in other ways. And so I've never been more, like, present. And so I think the connections that we had were actually so much deeper than connections where you can talk, because you can just fall back on words and you can say things that you're not necessarily feeling. But if you can't use words, you have to communicate with how you're feeling. So you have to be really present with how you're feeling and really present with how the other person is feeling, not using words. And so I would sit around with, like, there was a few different, like, young people who were all, like, they were all only a couple years younger than me. I think I was only 23 at that point, and they were, a lot of them were, like, 19, 20, 21, and we would just be with each other, and we wouldn't use words, and if we needed something, we would kind of act it out or whatever, or they would teach me the word in Tamil, and we just connected so incredibly deeply on this, like, whole other level than I ever had before. To the point that when I left Sri Lanka, that was the most painful thing I'd ever experienced in my life. I was a disaster. I sobbed in the car on the drive over to Colombo, and I'd given myself a few days on the beach, and I literally sat on the beach and just sobbed for, like, 4 days until my plane came back, and then continued to just cry. Like, it was the rupturing of that connection was, like, incredibly, incredibly painful. So I think it was, like, another step on that level of, like, understanding, like, how my experience, like, didn't matter to them. Like, that was really interesting too, of thinking that I was just had this whole other, like, presence there. And in the same way, like, obviously I had this privilege that I could be there and that I could leave at any point. If violence started again, I was gone, but that didn't matter to them. Like, there was no, like, there was this, like, you come from another land and you look very different type of thing, but it didn't signify anything to them. And that was really freeing. Like, everything I identified with that made me, what I thought made me who I am, didn't. So going back to what I was saying about Chile, it was another chance to be like, okay, so if who your family is doesn't identify you, if, you know, where you grew up doesn't identify you, if all these other things don't, then what, like, what makes me who I am? What makes me human? And I think that was it, like, connecting and being like, being able to just laugh with someone over something really silly and little, like, that's huge. And being able to, like, have dance parties, we had dance parties all the time, and, like, just being able to go and have a dance party, them do dances that look completely different, and then you do one that's normal to you, and they just crack up laughing that you look ridiculous.
Leslie knows that.
Yeah. I would be like, my sister-in-law Leslie does this. It's called finger pointing.
And it's incredibly graceful and beautiful. So how do you bring that back, that spirit of what it means to be you in your most basic sense?
It's hard. It's so hard. I mean, I think it's hard just in your own culture. So I'm sure that that would be hard for, like, a Sri Lankan within the Sri Lankan culture, definitely. So I think it's really difficult. I think the way that I try to do it is just to try to ask myself constantly how I'm identifying and how I'm defining myself and how I'm connecting to people around me. And, you know, I think after that, I got really into like meditation and specifically meditating on the idea of identity and impermanence and what it means to just be alive and to be in a moment. And really there is nothing to like identify ourselves at that, like identity is an illusion kind of idea. I would meditate on that a lot, and it's hard. And I think I've struggled with it the most in being in the same place for the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. Like that's what's gotten really tough, because it's so easy when you're jumping around and you're just meeting new people because you are redefining yourself every time. And it made it easy. But then to now be in the same place for a few years and to have a community and to have a partner and to have a job, like those are all really easy ways to start to identify and be like, this is who I am.
And in America, because America naturally, obviously, I know the American culture better than any other culture, but we really want you to pick a lane so that we know how to immediately either connect or disconnect with you.
Absolutely.
It's like, pick your lanes, let me know what they are, and then we'll decide whether we are friends or not.
And I think, you know, the three of us have been talking about this recently, but I think the added element, at least for our reality in America, not everyone's reality, is that not just pick a lane, but like make sure you pick the best one, and you've got, for us, like almost unlimited lanes to pick.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so pick the best one, and then the lane you choose to pick and the ones you didn't choose also defines you.
Yeah.
Whereas in a lot of other cultures and a lot of other countries and situations, they don't have that option. It's do whatever is the lane in front of you.
Right.
And that's it. You got no choice. You have no choice in it. And so I do think it's like all this added pressure then to do that. So I'm not only like naturally identifying as something, but I'm choosing my identity and I'm choosing like, this is who I'm going to be. And so even just being a social worker and the type of social work that I do, like, what does that say? You know, as soon as I tell someone I'm a social worker, I always have to pick which word I use for what I do with certain people, because social worker has so many connotations, and counselor and therapist and like all the different trauma counselor. If I throw a different word in, like, I'm always hyper aware of who I'm talking to and what their experience might be before I say what I do. Mm-hmm. And even that's like a tiny thing that I'm identifying with. It's way more complicated, I would say now.
So, Mama Bears, we're doing it a little differently this week. We'll be back on Wednesday, like always, but instead of having a Mama Bear mini, we will actually have part two of our conversation with Kate, as well as our dare at the end of that episode. In the meantime, remember to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and tell us how you're liking part one. And then we'll meet you back here on Wednesday.